This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, for the 22nd year in a row, community activists vow never to stop fighting for the freedom of Black political prisoners and to reunite their families. And a noted scholar and activist explains how white supremacy shapes U.S. domestic and foreign policy.
But first, Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has caused a big stir in left political circles with his latest article titled Intersectionality is a Hole, Afro-Pessimism is a Shovel, We Need to Stop Digging. Dixon says the term intersectionality has become a tool to pull people away from class-based struggle against the capitalist rulers. Dixon appeared on the long-running and highly influential Chicago radio program, This Is Hell, hosted by Chuck Mertz.
Before we talk about intersectionality and your critique of it, you know, we got to tell people what intersectionality is, which was a term that was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who was on our show back in 2015. She coined the term back in 1989. And it's a theory which considers that the various aspects of humanity, such as class, race, sexual orientation, and gender, do not exist separately from each other, but are completely interwoven and that their relationships are essential to an understanding of the human condition. Is your argument that you don't believe class, race, sexual orientation, and gender are interwoven?
Of course not. And I would characterize what intersectionality is a little differently than what you say, because you didn't really talk about the origin, what Professor Kimberly Crenshaw was trying to do. When she coined the word, she was an anti-discrimination lawyer, and what she's trying to do is she's trying to get the legal profession to pick up on intersectionality as a term and a basis for ruling in class action lawsuits. So she was not arguing about the liberation of women or overthrowing capital or changing the world. She was arguing about how discrimination lawsuits should be settled in and by the courts, which is different from saying that it's about the oppression of women everywhere and all the rest of it. She was making a limited argument about how courts rule and how courts distribute the pain, essentially. Who gets laid off? How many people get laid off? This kind of thing.
Right. And so you're saying that translating the legal argument into a political argument, that's where the problem occurs?
That's exactly where the problem occurs. People assume that she's making a set of political arguments that she's not making. And this is a way of not really examining those political arguments and not really examining the origin of the word intersectionality and what it's being used for. Intersectionality has picked up a life of its own outside the legal circles now, where people decide that it means all kinds of other things that Kimberly Crenshaw didn't and hasn't said it ought to mean. And it's kind of a confusing word. You know, once it's escaped out there into the wild beyond of a courtroom and the legal journals by which we try to persuade judges how they're supposed to rule, it becomes a political football, and then people do what they want to do with it based on their politics, or they base their politics on what their understanding of the word is. And the foundation sector really likes the word intersectionality. There's a link in our piece there to a piece by the Ford Foundation president. You know, he says we have to be more intersectional in our thinking. And when you go to the Borealis Fund page, and the Borealis Fund has printed stuff saying that they want to give tens of millions of dollars to Black Lives Matter organizations and other organizations that are pushing intersectionality. They've got an intersectional program fund. So intersectionality is being pushed on us not by people who want to change the world, but by foundations, which are the 1% way of dictating and controlling the so-called social movement in this country.
And you point out how intersectionality is very popular within the highest ranks of the Democratic Party, very popular with Hillary Clinton. So what do you...
And academia, it's really popular in the academy.
And
really.
So what do you think attracts groups like the Borealis Foundation, like the Ford Foundation, like the very top elites within the Democratic Party? What do you think attracts them to intersectionality?
What attracts them to intersectionality is that it's not solidarity. See, the root of the problem is that the U.S. left is not made up of and not led by or dominated by any class-conscious organizations or class-oriented formations. It's a bunch of squabbling interest groups, mostly based on, well, you got the blacks over here, you've got the Latinos over there, you've got the environmentalists over here in their corner, and that's the left, and they're all vying for careers and grants. And since they are not class conscious and class oriented, they're often unable to cooperate on any significant project and definitely unable to contend for power, as Jane McGillivray likes to say. They don't share a common power analysis. Whatever they do cooperate on, which isn't much, they can't use that to strive for power, because they're not class-oriented. And this also is at the root of why some of these organizations cannot be reliable allies to each other. Because if you're going to be a reliable ally, and they've kind of made that word mean God knows what it means, but if you're going to be a reliable partner in the struggle, you have to share some goals. And intersectionality kind of robs us of any class-conscious goals that we're supposed to pursue. It demotes class to something that's alongside of species and ableism and veganism and the rest of the stuff, instead of it being how society is organized. So it's kind of a handicapped and constrained way of looking at the world that the funders would like to continue to be the norm.
So,
and it is the norm right now in academia.
What's the difference then between solidarity and intersectionality? Doesn't intersectionality promote solidarity? Isn't solidarity based on intersectionality? That is, intersectionality causes solidarity?
Well, that's the kind of confusion that they might want to sow. A great guest that you should think about including sometime is a guy named Jeffrey B. Perry. He's the guy that I know that has the best explanation of this. He's the biographer of Hubert Harrison. And he was a labor activist in the Post Office Workers Union in Jersey City for 25, 30 years. And he says that solidarity is something that you develop in the course of common struggle, whereas he hasn't talked about intersectionality, but we're going to run something on intersectionality by Jeff Perry this coming week. Intersectionality is everybody coming forth based on what's in their section. Well, I'm black. And so you want to have a partnership with me chasing what I want to do. And intersectionality doesn't give various movements, various constituent organizations a really good enough reason to be great allies and great partners, because none of the organizations share a class analysis, and intersectionality explicitly denigrates class analysis and makes it equal, co-equal, like I said, with speciesism, ableism, veganism, and other stuff like that.
So how can solidarity better address what you see as any class struggle than intersectionality? To what degree do you think intersectionality is impractical, impossible, non-pragmatic, and solidarity is actually a practical, possible, and pragmatic way to address a class struggle? Because this is the way in which many people the reason that many people are embracing intersectionality. They see it as something that is pragmatic, something that does bring about, is practical, something that does bring about solidarity. So how do you see intersectionality as impractical, non-pragmatic?
Impractical, non-pragmatic, it doesn't lead to contending for power. It doesn't lead to that. It leads to coalitions between organizations or non-coalitions. It leads to squabbling as separate interest groups instead of coordinating and coming together around making a power analysis and struggling for power. Intersectionality doesn't necessarily lead there. The analogy that I used in my second piece was that of, biologists have identified about 100 bird species they call brood parasites. The brood parasite lays its eggs in the nest of a host species, and then the host species brings up this hostile alien chick that kills all of its nest mates and maybe kills the parents too, because it is a parasite. And the concept of intersectionality, like I said, was not given to us by Sojourner Truth. It wasn't given to us by Claudia Jones or any of these historic black socialists and other women who've been struggling all these years. It came to us from the legal world, and now it's being pushed upon us by the funded foundation world and by politicians. And it's up to those of us who are actually engaged in the struggle to make our own language and not allow Hillary Clinton, not allow the Ford Foundation to decide what our language is, because they're going to decide what our language is in a way that will confuse us and is confusing us. Intersectionality is kind of like that broodmare. What we're doing is we're coming up with terms that, instead of making our tasks and our situation clearer, make it more murky and vague.
So how do you see intersectionality then as a threat to feminism? How could intersectionality lead to undermining feminism?
There's two intersectionalities, okay? There's Kimberly Crenshaw's intersectionality and the what we'll call the bourgeois intersectionality that corporations are pushing. And then there's an intersectionality that real left feminists are pushing. The problem is that they both have the same name. And since they both have the same name, adherents of the corporate version of intersectionality are able to claim credit for the work that the real left feminists do. And the real left feminists are not always able to have their work and their views distinguished from the other intersectionalists. Look at the Women's March that happened 2 or 3 weeks ago. You had 100,000, 200,000 women in a number of places, actually more than that, probably a million in different places around the country, but none of them were protesting against the war. Cindy Sheehan, who you should also have, I guess you've already had her, but she's heading up trying to get a march on the Pentagon. They have marches on Washington 3 times, 4 times a year with 100,000 people, but they haven't marched on the Pentagon in 50 years, since 1968 or 69. And none of the intersectionalists who were running the Pink Hat Parade, when Cindy Sheehan came to them and said, why don't you participate in a march against war, a march on the Pentagon, they said, well, no, we're not going to participate in that until after all women are free. That's an example of how intersectionality is being played out by actual organizations. That's running away from solidarity and running away from contending for power, running away from educating people instead of toward it.
You're right that Melissa Harris Perry was lauded as a leading intersectionalist. At the same time, she aggressively defended the government's right to intercept and record every email, text message, phone call, and electronic brain fart on the planet and store them for future inspection. Democracy Now!, and that is funded by the Ford Foundation, which has given more airtime to intersectionality than perhaps anybody, refused to cover the lynching and ethnic cleansing of black Libyans during Obama's 2012 war on that unhappy country, even though they had a correspondent on the ground. To this day, Democracy Now! Dependably spouts U.S. propaganda justifying Obama's and Trump's war on Syria. So how does intersectionality, in your opinion, lead to support for or a lack of criticism of surveillance and war?
That's what it does. What it does is it does not enable us to tell what we're doing from what Melissa Harris Perry is doing, what Michelle Obama is doing. That's just where a lot of your advocates of intersectionality are. And that's where the foundation sector would like to keep us. That's where the corporate sector would like to keep us. That's where Democrats would like to keep us. They don't want us criticizing their wars. They don't want us questioning how they run the world in a really substantive way. And you will look in vain for something from Kimberly Crenshaw about war and peace. And when you have wars, who suffers more than women? And women take care of children. Who suffers more than women and children from modern war? It would seem like a no-brainer, but apparently if it's a no-brainer, then maybe somebody has no brains. I don't know.
And in the title of your piece is also the term Afro-pessimism, which we should define and make sure people understand what that means. But how does intersectionality lead to Afro-pessimism? And tell our audience what Afro-pessimism is.
Well, there's some disagreement and discord on that. Afro-pessimism is a word that is most associated with a guy named Dr. Frank Wilderson, who you should also have on your show. Hell, at UC Irvine now, Wilderson was the author of a book, a really wonderful book called Incognito, a memoir of exile and apartheid, where he relates his time, he's an American, when he was a low-level or mid-level official in the ANC, right around the time that Mandela was released and the first elections took place in South Africa. And he tells a story of that contributes to a real understanding of how Chris Hani died and how the African National Congress was taken onto the course where it is now. And right now the ANC, unfortunately, is massively corrupt and really the servants of capital in South Africa.
Bruce, one last question. Earlier on this morning's show, we spoke with historian Paul Ortiz. He was on to talk about his book, An African-American and Latinx History of the United States. Paul cites Coretta Scott King, writing in the foreword of her book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke out sharply for all the poor in all their hues, for he knew if color made them different, misery and oppression made them the same. Paul also cites writing from a workers' newspaper about how Dr. King was about bringing together workers as well at underneath these kind of same common cause ideas. So wasn't Dr. King an intersectionalist?
No, Dr. King was not an intersectionalist. The word wasn't made up until 21 or 22 years after Dr. King died. So it's a projection back in time on a guy who's dead to make Dr. King or Sojourner Truth or Claudia Jones or the Kohambi ladies, to make them intersectionalists when they were not even alive when the word was coined. They were for uniting these struggles. A little known piece of history is that in Memphis in 1968, the garbage worker strike that started when I think a couple of garbage workers got caught in the machine and killed, to this day, garbage workers are in the top five of the most dangerous jobs in America. And if you took out the garbage workers that work for some cities like New York City and Chicago, where they have some benefits in an actual union, if you remove the government sector and just talked about private industry garbage workers, they probably go up from number five to about number two or three in the most dangerous jobs in America. When you thank people for their service, these are the people you should be thanking. Okay, not the military, because they do more for you every day than the military, and they pay a higher price than the military does, at least in the short run. I don't think garbage workers have to do PTSD for 20 years afterwards, you know, like military folks do. But there was a situation akin to a general strike in Memphis. The high school students were staying home. There were big marches of 10, 15, 20,000. They were about to pull kids out of the grade schools, too. So they were shutting down city workers. They were shutting down private industry. There was a situation akin to a general strike at the moment before Dr. King was shot and killed in Memphis. So obviously, yeah, I guess that answers your question.
In his interview with This Is Hell host Chuck Mertz, Bruce Dixon made reference to Jeffrey B. Perry, the esteemed activist and scholar. Perry has spent decades studying and popularizing the works of Hubert Harrison, the early 20th century black socialist, and Theodore Allen, author of The Invention of the White Race. Glenn Ford spoke with Jeff Perry.
This is a capitalist country. It's a white supremacist capitalist country. White supremacy has been central to how a ruling class has maintained control since the 17th century. We have to understand that, and we have to understand how it still functions today. You know, when I write, I talk about Harrison and Allen, and Harrison talks about the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea, and I take that to mean every issue we look at, let's see how black people are faring and what are we going to do about it, because every issue we look at in this society is shaped in a white supremacist fashion. And Harrison concludes, he's long active in the Socialist Party, and he leaves, and he says that the white socialists and the white labor movement put the white race before class. And that ties in directly with my work on Allen, who I came to 40 years ago. And Allen was looking at much of the same situation that Bruce Dixon is describing in his last two articles, where he says, look, we really don't have an organized class-conscious left showing true solidarity. And when Allen starts out writing, he tries to analyze, why is that the case? Why is there no socialism? Why is there such a low level of class consciousness in this country? And his conclusion is white supremacy is the principal retardant to class consciousness. And it leads him step by step into his work on the invention of the white race. And he argues that the white race was invented back in the 17th century. And he goes into long, very detailed, and I have articles all over and on my webpage, and the video is up 120 some odd thousand views. I encourage listeners to take a look at it, in my video talk on Allen's invention of the white race. But he describes how in the 17th century, European Americans and African Americans for much of the century fought together. They had much commonality of experience and showed labor solidarity in various struggles. And in response to labor solidarity, because that was one of the topics you wanted to talk about, the ruling elite turns to what becomes the invention of the white race, a system whereby they confer privileges on the European Americans, racial privileges. They extend and deepen the oppression of the African Americans, the racial oppression. And they do this, and they maintain it over the next few hundred years as the key to how they maintain social control in this country. And even at the time of the Civil War, when some people think there's going to be change, it's quickly reconstituted in a white supremacist fashion when there's that door is there possibly for some serious change. So the U.S. ruling elite has consistently relied on white supremacy for social control. And that's very important to understand, because a lot of, you know, the other analyses out there don't look at the history of how this developed in this country and the capitalist nature that's behind so much of this and the function, the social control function that white supremacism plays and white privileges play. Allen's work, I'll just point out two other things he does. He makes very effective arguments that racism is not innate and that these privileges are not in the interests of not only not in the interest of African Americans, but they're not in the interest of European American working people, which is a very profound concept and different than much that you hear elsewhere. But Allen is talking about class interests, and he's talking about the class interest, the struggle, the class struggle that is needed in this country. So in Allen's work, he argues that given some of that background that I just described, in the U.S., in the capitalist setup of the U.S., white supremacism is both the keystone and the Achilles heel of U.S. capitalist rule. It's what they rely on, but it's the issue we got to take them on and beat them on, because they're ultimately they're most vulnerable on that. And if we look back through history, when we can make progress in that area, lots of other doors begin to open. For instance, in the 60s, when the civil rights, black liberation struggle were making some significant gains, you saw the growth of the anti-war movement, the labor movement, the women's movement, various things like that. So that's some of the things that I think are very important in the work of Allen and Harrison. And I kind of used that approach when I worked in the post office. And again, I did 33 years in the post office because just let me step back for a second. I mean, a lot of the talk today is the white working class, you know, and they're all behind Trump and all of this. Much work has to be done there. And I feel that's a particular responsibility of European Americans to go do that work, right? And to challenge this white supremacy. That means getting into the communities, into the workplaces. But you've got to take it on historically. You've got to take it on in practice. You've got to show true solidarity. You've got to stand with your fellow brothers and sisters in the African-American struggle and other struggles.
Well, yes, I know a little bit about your background as an organizer and officer in union activities in the U.S. Postal Service. There was, in fact, a clash between a black-led union and a white-led, and some say mafia-dominated union within the Postal Service. And race, of course, became a key element in the struggle between those two unions purporting to represent the workers.
Yes, I started back in Jersey City, which you're familiar with, Jersey City, and there was a big bulk mail center there, 4,000 workers, which was created in the wake of the 1970 postal strike under the Postal Reorganization Act. The government wanted to turn to a whiter workforce, so they built all these bulk mail centers outside the inner cities. And even though Jersey City is close to Bed-Stuy and Harlem and Newark, transportation is difficult. And the labor makeup of the workforce went from 80% maybe in New York and Chicago down to 25% black and Latin in Jersey City, right? And they built this big 4,000 worker facility. It was one of 21, I believe, of a hubs and spokes system. So when I went in there, there were several unions. The one that I was in was the mail handlers union, which was black led, but it was organized crime dominated. And they also at the facility had an Italian-American association, the Columbia Association, that dominated the plant, the work plant. I remember when I went to my first labor management meeting and there were 12 managers on the other side and they were all members of the Columbia Association. I couldn't believe it. So we waged considerable struggle there, sometimes with the left too, because there were others in the left who were active leftists, but they did not really put the struggle against white supremacy as central, as key to the work they were undertaking. And I thought, and some others agreed with me, right, that this, we had to do that in that workplace and throughout the society. So we set out on that course, and it took time. We got fired sometimes. We had strikes out there. But by the early 80s, I was elected the head of the mail handlers union at that facility. And we started taking on issues. And what we did was every issue in the workplace, we tried to come out every week. Back then, this is pre-computer for the most part, you know, how we do it nowadays. But we'd have weekly bulletins, and we would put out every week bulletins, 2-4 pages. And every issue we looked at not only how were the bosses messing with us or how was the society, you know, capitalism and generalism affecting working people, but how was white supremacy shaping that issue? And we tried to address it. That we were constantly, you know, rat-tat-tat, all the time. That was one thing we did. Another thing is we looked within the workplace and we plotted the workplace and we charted. We were very organized how we're going to go. We're going to get people starting to talk to people because Jersey City, like many places in this country, Jersey City borders Bayonne. There's real polarized areas of Jersey City. People didn't often talk. And our workplace was 75% white still, right, at that time. And we got, you know, we got people communicating. Not surprisingly, black leaders stepped to the fore in terms of our facility leadership, in terms of the union apparatus, chief stewards, heads. We set up committees in all these areas, women's committees, grievance committees, and the like. We organized, and then we took on issues. And so many times, the issues we would look at, light duty denial, and it's mostly black women who were pregnant were being denied light duty, which you're supposed to get. Discipline, a black worker would get double the offense that a white worker would get. And we're exposing all this stuff, and we're exposing that Columbia Association, as I told you. And one of the most interesting ones was when it came to overtime in the workplace, because there was a long tradition that these supervisors would dole out, and overtime was desired because the wages were low, and the supervisors would dole out overtime. And invariably, the white workers would get the overtime. Black workers wouldn't. So all of a sudden, we come in, this new branch at union administration. We say, wait a minute. No, we're doing this on a rotating basis. We're not playing that game anymore. And people are looking. First off, some people are looking, is this for real? How long is this going to last? And some of the white workers are ready to come to blows. You know, you're taking money out of my pocket. But as we did this and we maintained it, we moved forward with kind of a principal position, I think we earned considerable respect amongst the workforce. Then one manifestation of the work we were doing and how successful it was in the around 86, I guess it was, we not only coordinated the big statewide anti-apartheid meeting out of our workplace. This is a statewide, coming out of the workplace. And it was held in Jersey City, as a matter of fact, that statewide march. But we had in that workplace, out of 4,000 workers, we had 75% white, right? We had 3,000 people wearing anti-apartheid buttons, people who never in their life would dream of doing such a thing. So these were some of the signs, and I've written elsewhere, I've talked about some of the other manifestations. And we also, when we're in there and we're working, we emphasize that, listen, this is not an overnight struggle. You got to stay at it day in, day out, every day, using that insight from Harrison. It's the touchstone, every issue. We've got to look at how's it affecting it, right? And I believe, I'm pretty convinced from my life experience, we can make those gains, but it's a lot of education and activism and work amongst the working people, because they're fed, as you point out earlier, they're fed. They oftentimes live in their isolated communities. They're fed this media domination. This is what they get all the time. And we've got much work to do.
Yes, workers can be forgiven sometimes, black workers and white workers, if they get confused when they hear about the centrality of race in American life, and race has certainly been central to American life, and they hear of the necessity to put class center in political struggle.
Yeah, well, back then when I was writing, in the post office, but a lot of other things, I wrote a big, long article on the developing conjuncture and talks about Harrison and Allen's work. And I go through a statistical analysis where I describe how in the U.S., for instance, this was done a few years ago, but what I say is basically true still to this day, the gap between rich and poor is at record proportions. Poor and working people are suffering throughout this country. When compared to other advanced capitalist countries, we fare worse in health care, in maternity leave, paternity leave, all these measures. You can put together the facts and help explain things to people. But then when you look more closely, each and every one of these issues is also shaped in a white supremacist fashion. So if you look at incarceration rates, they run 3, 4 times, 5 times, whatever the number, current number is, to one. Unemployment rates is nominally 2 to 1, black to white. But there's a whole history there, too, because the black to white unemployment ratio, just as a sidebar, was 1 to 1 at the start of the Great Depression back in 1929. And it was only after the programs of the New Deal and the post-war redeployment that it became 2 to 1. That's when, around the time I'm born. And that's all we've known throughout our lifetimes, roughly a black to white 2 to 1 unemployment. And that was through all those government policies and programs, which again reaffirms the point that the ruling class plays a role in shaping all of this.
In other words, the wage and other gaps owe a lot to the fact that white workers and white folks in general have gotten some relief from the New Deal and its successors, and blacks have gotten less.
Yes, and that continues. And the whole notion of conferring of privileges, Allen makes a fascinating point, I think, when he talks about the history of class struggle. Another one of his very important points, and one which we should keep our antennas up for in the current period, is past history of this country in key periods of struggle, being period of Reconstruction, populism one, two, the populist period was the second one he referred to, and the third being the Depression 30s, when the laboring classes and poor and oppressed people started coming together to some degree to struggle for better conditions, the ruling class turns to white supremacy to beat back struggle from below, and they confer and extend more privileges on the European Americans, on the white workers. So we have to be aware, you know, that that's always one of the main aspects of how they go to fight back. Now, what Alan points out is what's so pernicious about this, because his book is about the white race, and he says it's invented as a ruling class social control formation. And the white race is a multi-class formation. So part of the work I do is I try and get people to think more deeply about what it means to be, quote, white. There are some people out there, and Bruce, and I think you talk about the nonprofit industry out there making a lot of money, you know, promoting all these talks and stuff. But Alan writes that there's nothing progressive in thinking or being white. You know, challenge that, because all it's ever been in this country is a class collaborative formation. He's not saying you become black or anything like that, but you try and join the human race, become a European American, but challenge that white identity, because it's taken as a given, and he's very critical of that notion.
You were speaking to the fact that the United States lags in almost all social categories behind other developed industrial nations, and many folks contend that it is because of white supremacy, because of a lack of social contract, which is another way of saying a lack of solidarity among folks in the United States, that we have these terrible social indices compared to other industrial countries.
I agree. The working class movement is so weak in this country. I think the principal reason, the principal retardant of class consciousness has been white supremacism, in the particularly in the labor movement. It's kept us, I think, from developing a strong working class leadership for social issues. In the 70s and 80s, when Alan was putting this together, that's what he was talking about. How do we explain the lack of class consciousness in this country? He attributes it mostly to white supremacism, which I think is an accurate appraisal, assessment of it, because these European American workers are often identifying more with their white bosses than with their black co-workers. Not showing solidarity with the black co-workers, but playing a role supporting the interest of the white owners and bosses and the like.
Most of the time we talk about white supremacy and its impact on politics, we're talking about domestic politics. But this is capitalism at the stage of imperialism. And yes, we note that the U.S. labor movement does not take an anti-imperialist position, that the Democratic Party, which is dependent on the votes of blacks and other non-whites, does not take a progressive position on U.S. imperialism, and is in some ways at this stage even more warmongering party than the Republicans. So white supremacy and imperialism should be part of this conversation as well.
Yes, without a doubt. And white supremacy is key. That's a key role that's played. The U.S. exports these notions also when you look at the role it plays in Africa or Latin America, Asia. It's central to what they're putting out there. White supremacy is key to U.S. imperialism. And that's why, if we can begin, and the struggle will come from struggle domestically and maybe struggle abroad, but we have to go after this powerful U.S. ruling elite. We need to build a class-conscious movement that is anti-white supremacist. But for many of the organizations, I don't want to get out there calling names and everything like that, they might have their list of what they're opposed to, and they'll list 5, 6, 7, 8 topics. And number 6 or number 7 might be racism, right? And so it's not as central as I think it needs to be, because we have to get people to understand that it is the central issue holding the U.S. capitalist system together. It's what they rely on. If we can beat them on this issue, we can make great gains in all these other areas, and all the other areas are related. If you're looking at women's issues, white supremacy is going to play a major issue in incarceration. Pick an issue, right? White supremacy is going to be very central in all those issues. So we've got to work in those areas.
In New York City last week, the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee held its 22nd annual dinner in tribute to black political prisoners and their families. Dequi Kioni Siddiqui chairs the committee.
For 22 years, this dinner is the space where we honor black resistance, the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army, our political prisoners and their families. The very essence, heart, and soul of black people's struggle for self-determination, justice, and liberation in this capitalist, imperialist, colonial, settler nation. For 22 years, this dinner makes space for us to recognize and show our appreciation and love to the families of our political prisoners for their intergenerational struggles and sacrifice, endurance, and commitment to the black freedom struggle. Can we please have some quiet, because we really want to give honor to the families and to our political prisoners who are not here. So really, respectfully, we want to say Sundiata Akoli, Imam Jamil Alameen, Herman Bell, Veronza Bowers, Romaine Chip Fitzgerald, Robert Seth Hayes, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rochelle Cinque McGee, Jaleel Muntakim, Ed Poindexter, Kamal Siddiqui, Dr. Matulu Shakur, Russell Maroon Schultz, and their families belong to us. And they belong to freedom-loving people all over the world. They are the manifestation of a people's freedom dreams and freedom work. Heroes and sheroes and freedom fighters in a 100-year tradition of black resistance. As U.S.-held political prisoners and prisoners of war, they are the unspoken, invisible, and buried alive legacy of the revolutionary movements of the 1960s and 70s that were neutralized by the FBI, local police, courts, and the corporate media by way of COINTELPRO. We gather here today to remember and recognize them as members of the Black Panther Party, servants of the people who got up in the wee hours of the morning to feed other people's hungry children, educate them, escort elders, clean up drug-infested communities, prevent evictions, and more. And for the past 30, 40 years, sometimes forgotten, sometimes not talked about or ignored, from one generation to another, they have been forced to endure the unyielding and unrelenting punishment of 800-plus collective years of political imprisonment, torture, abuse, repeated parole denials, and multiple generations of family separation. We honor their lives and sacrifices with the commitment we make to ourselves and each other to actively engage in the work of visiting, writing, sending money, providing support when needing, donating to our political prisoners' freedom campaigns, and advocating for their release with local, state, and federal elected officials. We honor them by making visible their invisibility, by speaking all their names in public spaces, loud and proud, anywhere and everywhere we go. We say Robert Seth Hayes, we say Mumia Abu-Jamal, we say Sundiata Akoli, Jamil Alameen, Veronza Bowers, Chip Fitzgerald, Seth, Rochelle, Jaleel, Ed Poindexter, Kamal Siddiqui, Matulu, Maroon, and we also speak the names of David Gilbert, Tom Manning, Bill Dunn, and Jan Lehman, our white anti-imperialist political prisoners. These are the radicals and revolutionaries who decades earlier were guided by such great love for the people that they placed their lives, families, and freedom in harm's way. And it is not right that save for a few of their names and campaigns are rarely, if ever, spoken aloud. We must change this. Every one of our political prisoners deserves the people's active and widespread support. Every one of our political prisoners fought not for individual recognition, personal gain, or aggrandizement, but for all poor and working class oppressed people's right to live with dignity, human rights, and justice in this horrifically violent, capitalistic, imperialist, and unjust white supremacist nation. We have a responsibility to our freedom fighters to organize and rebuild a movement that engages in the proactive work of demanding and fighting for all of their freedom. We cannot stress enough how urgent this is. Cindy Otta turned 81 years old 2 weeks ago. He ordered release by the New Jersey State Appellate Court, but the parole board appealed that ruling all the way to the state Supreme Court, and it was overturned. He was sent back to the parole board, denied release for the seventh time, and given a 15-year hit. Cindy Otta will be 95 years old before he is allowed to appear before the parole board again. Herman turned 70 years old 2 weeks ago. He and Cindy Otta share the same January 14th birthday. He suffered a savage and vicious assault by prison guards a few months ago. While docs claim to be conducting an investigation of the incident and the officers involved in the assault, the PBA, Daily News, and Post has already begun its every two-year campaign against his release. Herman will go before the parole board for the eighth time next month. Seth has suffered debilitating decades-long medical war on his body with doc's refusal, inability, or incompetence to adequately monitor and control his life-threatening diabetes. He will appear before the parole board for the 12th time later this year. Kamal Siddiqui is in prison solely on the basis of his refusal to accept the then $1 million bounty offered for the capture of Asada Shakur, the mother of one of his daughters. He was told then that if he did not cooperate, he would die in prison. Today, he suffers from life-threatening medical challenges that include ulcers on his legs, hepatitis C, and a disappointing lack of visits and support in a Georgia medical facility. Jaleel will appear before the parole board for a 10th time later this year. Neither he nor Matulu received any therapy or rehabilitation to address the trauma caused by strokes each of them suffered a few years back. And we all know the monumental struggle it took to get Mumia the life-saving Hep C medication he needed, and his medical struggles are not over. Maroon is quietly experiencing numerous health issues, among them a compromised equilibrium and inability to walk without falling down. Ed Poindexter is the lone survivor of the Omaha 2 ever since the death of his co-defendant, Mondo Wilanga. He's recovering from triple bypass heart surgery in a Nebraska state prison, isolated without much support, and trying to raise money for Innocence Project campaign for his release. These are just some of the realities of aging in prison, not just for our political prisoners, but for any elder in prison. Theirs, however, is compounded for these once younger revolutionaries who the power structure is determined that they die in prison. And some have. Noah, Ja, Teddy Ja, Bashir, Kwesi, Merle, Phil, Mondo, Richard, and Majid. That said, our political prisoners don't have the luxury of time on their side, nor do we. They need for us to commit ourselves to a creative, proactive, and unified effort to bring them home. They need us to bring more people, younger people, into the grassroots street organizing it will take to bring awareness to and highlight each one of their cases. They need us to raise funds for their campaign so lawyers can do their work in the courts while we do our work in the streets. Otherwise, the status quo silencing and invisibility that shrouds our political prisoners will continue, and more of them will suffer state-sanctioned medical neglect and murder behind the wall. And so it is today that we honor those whose work represents this effort. We honor those who spread the word, our revolutionary griots. Naya Arende of the Amsterdam newspaper, Sally O'Brien and Bashir M. Chawi of Where We Live's WBA, Where We Live and Education at the Crossroads, and Goma, the poetry man, activist and musician, photo documentarian Suwazi Afia Alusala of Dara Ancestral Beauty, Sophia Dawson of I Am Web Paint and To Be Free, and posthumously, Brother George Edward Tate. 50 years ago, Malcolm said the media was the most powerful entity on earth because of its ability to control the minds of the masses, that they make the guilty look innocent and the innocent look guilty. He couldn't have known how much more of the media today would be consolidated in the hands of a few multi-billion-dollar conglomerates, and that less and less of the people's historical and contemporary lives and struggles would be told without straight-up revisionism, outright lies, distortions, mythology, and the perversity of white supremacy, corporate greed, and vulture capitalism. This is where and when our revolutionary griots enter. Naya, Sally, Basia, and Goma, Sawazi, Sophia, and Brother Tate know well the narrative and perception most people have about black resistance, armed self-defense, the Black Panther Party, black liberation, and our political prisoners. They are our people's journalists, artists, and culture as a weapon warriors, using their media platform, human resources, considerable skills and talents to stand in the sacred tradition of black freedom fighting, history, and her story truth-telling. Like our political prisoners, they too carry the freedom work and freedom dreams of a people, standing up and speaking out about who our political prisoners be, who we be, and just how beautiful we are for all the world to see and hear. These revolutionary griots gift us anthems and praise songs across a 21st century cultural and political underground. Saying it, these revolutionary griots tell us, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. They have what Lorraine Hansberry called sighted eyes and healing heart, speaking truth to power about the lives and souls of a black nation terrorized but still standing in resistance to the genocide, enslavement, lynchings, Jim Crow apartheid, centuries of white supremacy, poverty, police terror and murder, miseducation, inadequate housing, gentrifying ethnic cleansing, and a multitude of untold horrors on this bloodied, stolen land. We thank you, Naya, Sally, Bashir, Ngoma, Sawazi, Sophia, and Tate, for using your camera, pen, mic, and paintbrush to educate everyone in sight about our captured freedom fighters. We thank you for your healing balm on our wounded psyche. We thank you for reminding us just how truly beautiful the black freedom struggle is, with such amazing beauty and grace and dignity and strength. We honor you for spreading the good word about black resistance, the black liberation movement, the Black Panther Party, our political prisoners, and their families. We thank each of these revolutionary griots for gifting and spreading the word about black resistance and our political prisoners. As this settler country grinds deeper into an already bursting hate-filled ideology of white supremacy, vulture capitalism, and imperialism, xenophobia, and militarized police state, we are sure to need more revolutionary griots springing forward. We will need more revolutionary griots to educate the people with a lyrical word or two that the criminalization and violent repression of black resistance did not begin with the armed self-defense tactics of the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army, but on those slave ships carrying kidnapped Africans across the Atlantic Ocean, on those plantations north and south where our ancestors killed slave owners with poison or machete, burned down crops, had hands, feet, and limbs chopped off, eyes burned out for daring to resist an unjust law that prohibited them from reading and writing, for refusing to be bred, or for simply running away. From Harriet Tubman to Nat Turner to Malcolm to Garvey to Asada, from 1619 and beyond, black folks' freedom dreams will not be crushed. Oppression breeds resistance, and we know that resistance brings on state repression. And so we know there are bound to be more political prisoners. It will be the role of the revolutionary griots to spread the word about the importance of working together, smarter, to eliminate fractionalism, individualism, vanguardism, cult of the personality, too little political education and development, lack of historical analysis and solidarity in action, and all the things that injure this work. We cannot afford for our struggle or what exists of it to continue to hemorrhage and be divided. We need as many of us as possible to remind ourselves that we must build and unite to sustain our work from the outside in and the inside out. And this includes all our political prisoners.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com.
where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.